From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. When they went to the polls on Sunday, Venezuelans sent one loud and clear message to the party of Hugo Chavez, and maybe to all of Latin America. After 17 years of Chavez-style leftist populism and its gleeful anti-Yankee foreign policy, Venezuelans had enough and swept the United Socialist Party out in a landslide. A collapsing economy and a crime wave were the last straw, but maybe people also voted for a new balance, a third way between left-wing populists and right-wing elites. This hour On Point, voting down Chavismo and what comes next. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you following this? What just happened in Venezuela? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will go to Paris to find out more about France's election and the big victories Sunday of Marine Le Pen's far-right anti-immigrant National Front Party. But first, joining me from Caracas, Venezuela, is Hannah Dreyer, Venezuela correspondent for the Associated Press. Hannah, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
What is the outcome, as far as we know now, in these elections, and what is the significance, the powers that the opposition will have?
So it's a total landslide. All we're waiting for at this point is to basically confirm that the opposition has won a supermajority in Congress. And it's the first time the opposition has won anything nationwide in 17 years. So it feels like a new Venezuela. The opposition can now do things like call a constitutional assembly. They can take steps to recall the president. They can throw out Supreme Court justices, rewrite laws. It's real power.
The victory is being called a landslide. It's also being called fragile. How do these two go together?
So the problem is that the opposition here isn't a single party. It's a coalition of a bunch of parties that have spent a lot of the last decade fighting among themselves. This time, for the first time, they all gathered together and ran as one. But nobody really expects that coalition to last after the elections. And you're already seeing it with some people saying that they need to immediately move to recall President Maduro. Other leaders are saying that would be a slap in the face to the Venezuelan people. A lot of these people in the opposition want to be president one day, and you can kind of see the coalition starting to fragment just 2 days after this huge victory.
Is Nicolas Maduro conceding that the time of his party is past, that Chavismo is over, or something else, Hannah?
No, Nicolas Maduro, I don't think we'll ever see him concede that Chavismo is past. He did recognize the results of the election, which was something that a lot of people had worried he wouldn't do. He got on TV seconds after the results were read out and said that democracy had triumphed. But then he immediately started talking about how this was all part of a U.S.-backed attempt to meddle in Latin American countries' business interests, waging an economic war here. So he's essentially giving the same stump speech he gave while he was trying to win this election. And I don't think many people see him changing his rhetoric going forward. The big question is whether his party will work behind the scenes with the opposition to actually run the country.
Hannah, what happened to the party that Hugo Chavez founded here? I mean, I'm reading results. They got wiped out in his home state, Barinas, that they lost all districts in Caracas, which were, you know, real strongholds for Chavez. What happened?
Yeah, in Barinas, his home state, not only did Chavismo lose, but Chavez's own brother got heckled when he went to vote, and another brother of his lost the election, which people here never thought would happen. Chavismo was in a lot of ways a cult of personality around Chavez. People still adore Chavez. They have pictures of him in their homes like a saint. His face is everywhere you go in Venezuela. But he died 2 years ago and people have been suffering since. The economic hardships here have started to really circumscribe people's lives. People have to skip work to go wait in line to buy food. People can't leave the country because of an unusual exchange rate system they have here. People can't buy clothes for their children. And what I'm hearing in the slums is that people feel like the revolution has grown heartless, has betrayed them. And for the first time, a lot of people are voting for opposition members who they never trusted before. And honestly, I don't know if they trust now.
Are people in Venezuela seeing this? There have been other elections in Latin America in recent months where left-leaning governments have not done so well. Are Venezuelans seeing themselves as part of a pushback of the what was has been called the pink wave that came to South America?
Yeah, I think the opposition here is definitely celebrating this as proof of the definitive ebbing of that pink tide. Chavez was the first leader to start that trend. He made Venezuela famous, ushering in what was supposed to be this regional revolution, all of Latin America turning to the left. And one by one, those leftist governments have been voted out of office. In Argentina, there was just a huge presidential upset there where the conservative candidate won. And here, people who support the opposition see it as the death knell, basically, of that revolution. Government supporters, of course, would tell you that it's just a small hiccup.
Hannah Dreyer with the Associated Press in Caracas, in Venezuela. Really appreciate your coming on for a minute here today, Hannah. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Here was Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro, whose party has just taken a drubbing. This was just after midnight on Monday, conceding defeat.
We acknowledge these unfavorable results. We accept them. And we want to say to Venezuela, this is a victory for democracy and our constitution.
He's not giving up on socialism. A Venezuelan woman here in the street, a member of the opposition coalition, the Democratic Unity Movement, talking with France 24 News just after midnight, same time that he was speaking. Here's savoring her opposition party's victory.
The joy in the streets all over the country is incredible. The emotion, the excitement, because we have a new National Assembly for all Venezuelans.
And Maduro, Venezuela's president, saying here that his party, yes, it had lost, but he said it lost because some group or groups he did not identify had waged what he called an economic war against him and his government.
Ha triunfado la guerra económica.
He says,
ha triunfado una estrategia.
I would say the economic war has triumphed. A strategy prevailed to undermine the collective confidence in a national project. The leader of the United Socialist Party in trouble after Sunday's vote in Venezuela. Welcome into our conversation right now from Mexico City, Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Policy Program at the Center for International Policy. Laura, in Mexico, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me.
And with us from Amherst, Massachusetts, Javier Corrales joins us, professor of political science at Amherst College, author of Presidents Without Parties and Dragon in the Tropics. Javier Corrales, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
What just happened in Venezuela, Javier?
Well, I think Hannah provided a really good summary. After 16 years of essentially one-party rule, the opposition was able to take power in one of the most important political institutions. And it did so defying even the expectations of the opposition leaders themselves. It was a really remarkable victory in every sector of Venezuela's society. And because this is a government that has never been used to having to deal with the opposition, many questions are emerging as to how these two movements are going to get along from now on. But there's no question that room has to be made for the opposition after 17 years of not making any room for it.
Laura, are you confident that the government, we heard President Maduro there saying he'll, democracy has spoken in effect, but are you confident that they will stand by as maybe this new coalition dismantles what Chavismo built in government infrastructure?
Well, I think it's very clear that they're accepting the vote and they will not try to obstruct the opposition taking power in the legislature. And also that this means that Maduro will have to enter into a new phase of listening more and beginning to take a more conciliatory position. However, it's probably not correct to exaggerate the power that the legislature has, because this is still a fairly presidentialist, as we call it here in Latin America, system. And so their ability and their willingness or the desirability of dismantling Chavismo at a rapid rate from the minute of taking power is really in question. In the first place, because a lot of the state institutions after 17 years of Chavismo are still in the hands of the president's party and followers, and those kinds of changes would take a long time. But in the second place, if they do, they're going to face a lot of political challenges. And not just from the presidency. If the conservatives decide to immediately roll back social programs, you can imagine what the response of the poor, even many of whom disenchanted with Chavismo, voted for the conservatives and for the opposition, would be. They're not in a position to have those social programs rolled back. In fact, they've already made indications that they are not going to begin, you know, come right off the bench with this major program to dismantle. Other than that, the platform's a bit vague on the part of the opposition, so a lot of it is kind of a wait-and-see situation.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Venezuela voting to turn back the Hugo Chavez revolution, a kind of historic rejection of hard-left populism at the polls in Venezuela, and it's widely being said a wider questioning, turning back of the pink tide in Latin America. Javier Corrales is with us from Amherst College. Laura Carlson with us from the Center for International Policy. You can join us this hour. Did you think the Chavez movement was forever? Did you think Venezuelans would ever vote it down, vote it out? And what went wrong with Chavismo, with the movement that swept in as the champion of the poor Venezuelans? What just happened in your country? If you throw your mind back, of course, Hugo Chavez was a big talker, could talk for hours and hours and did on national television, a big cult of personality there. Even as recently, here he was in 2009 at the Copenhagen Climate Change Conference. Classic Chavez-style speech here, railing against imperialism. He died in 2013 from complications of cancer. So Chavez saying in Copenhagen, can we hope for something democratic, inclusive from the current global system? What we're experiencing on this planet is an imperial dictatorship, and from here we continue denouncing it. Down with imperial dictatorship, and long live the people and democracy and equality on the planet. In the run-up to the elections in Venezuela on Sunday, lots of concern among opposition leaders that it would not be a clean and fair election. Here was the opposition leader, Jesus Torrealba, predicting dirty tricks. This was Saturday before the election. He's saying this is the dirtiest electoral process in the last 17 years in this country. Let the government know the victory. We're going to make them pay. And then, after the election, a big victory for the opposition, and here's Jesus Torrealba again.
The country wants a change, and the change begins today. The agenda of peace reigns. The agenda of the citizens was imposed. The vote democratically defeated the government that isn't democratic.
Big change in Venezuela. Javier Corrales, how do you explain the depth of this defeat for the ruling party in Venezuela? What has gone wrong for them?
It's important to talk about the economics and the political causes. Economically, Venezuela is a mystery. It experienced the most formidable economic boom during the 2000 when the price of oil reached very high levels. No other Latin American country received as much money, as many dollars as the Venezuelan government did. And today, Venezuela is in ruins.
What's mysterious about that? The price of oil has collapsed.
It is mysterious because we don't see any other petrostate suffering as high. It seemed as if most of the money that went in kind of disappeared. The investment is not there. You don't just have a slowdown. You have every economic institution in ruins. The price of oil has gone down, but it's still very high for historic levels. at $40 a barrel approximately. The destruction is particularly high because the institutions in place to manage the windfall were perverse. So you're seeing a crisis like no other in Venezuela and across oil states in the planet at the moment. I'm talking about the highest level of inflation in the world, one of the most devalued currencies in the planet, and scarcity as if you were living in a Soviet-era style country, basic consumer goods missing from the shelves. We haven't seen anything like this.
How do you explain it? You call it a mystery, but give us your best explanation of why the economic collapse has been so dire.
The government used the revenue to essentially spend the money on consumption instead of investment. It had a policy of enormous regulatory restrictions on the business sector, and so the business sector, the private sector, began to collapse. The government relied during the good times on imports as the private sector was collapsing. And a lot of this distribution was given out without generating new human capital or new forms of investment. So everything was dependent on the state pumping money into the economy. Debts were acquired, deficits were acquired, and you started to see a bunch of distortions. And when the money stopped flowing, these economic institutions that were set in place, heavy spending, a lot of borrowing, and restrictions on the private sector, took their toll on the economy.
Laura Carlson, we heard President Maduro there in the tape we played saying that this was a result of an economic war on Venezuela. Is there any evidence of that?
Not concrete evidence. Essentially what he's saying is that the United States has backed an economic war, and the central part of this allegation has to do with accusing businesses, including supermarket chains, of hoarding food to sabotage the economy, and which may be due either to, you know, a political movement or even just self-interested kind of price speculation there. And there is some evidence of hoarding. There's also evidence that organized crime and petty smugglers have been involved in smuggling and hoarding as well. And this is at the center of a lot of the scarcities that we see. But much of this is self-inflicted. There's no denying that whatsoever, because really at the root of these problems, even the problems that he himself cites when he talks about the economic war, are two fatal decisions of the Venezuelan government, which are the price controls and price fixing, which were an attempt to subsidize the poor and provide access to basic goods, a laudable goal, but that completely got out of control, and an utterly dysfunctional exchange rate system, where you have the rate of exchange officially it's like 100 times overvalued compared to what the black market rate is.
And why is that? Why has that been implemented, Laura? Why?
Well, they were implementing it to support importers and then also, again, to create a situation that would benefit the lower classes, but it's got completely out of control and nobody knows how to exactly roll it back at this point. Is probably one of the major errors of Chavismo that had created what is really a situation of Venezuela economically today is a basket case, and that's the punishment vote that Chavismo is reaping today. So these are the kinds we're looking at, a 10% decrease in GDP projected by the IMF and World Bank for 2015 with another recession in 2016, and unemployment going up as well, and inflation as at over 100%, and in fact, in some ways, because of the lack of indicators, it could be even more. So we've got this situation, along with the historical progress that the Bolivarian Revolution made in terms of reducing poverty, between these social programs that are now costing more than the government can afford, and some of the problems that are have developed from the, particularly the exchange rate, the government is and the economy is at an impasse that somehow the new legislature and the president are going to have to work together to resolve.
Javier Corrales, as you and Laura describe this, it sounds almost like the classic, this economic collapse sounds like the classic, what, stereotype of a dysfunctional socialist burnout.
It is the stereotype of a Latin America that doesn't exist anymore. This was there. A lot of what we're seeing in Venezuela are things that we saw in the 80s when the region was run by military regimes or incredibly incompetent elites. A lot has changed in Latin America, but Venezuela didn't change. This point that Laura mentioned about the establishment of exchange rate controls were tried before in Venezuela and elsewhere, and it produced very similar effects. It is remarkable that Venezuela in the mid-2000s would rely so much on these exchange rate controls as well as price controls. They were relied to an excess, and the results were very predictable. It didn't occur sooner simply because the price of oil kept it afloat artificially much longer, but the moment that this support disappeared, we're seeing this result. So yes, you're right. It is stereotypical of a Latin America that, fortunately for the rest of the region, doesn't exist. You go, for example, to Bolivia or Ecuador. Both countries are run by leftist administrations. Both countries rely on energies. They're suffering as a result of the decline in energy prices worldwide, but nothing compared to Venezuela. You're right that it is a stereotype and in some ways a tragic stereotype of an era long gone, but still very much present in Venezuela.
What strikes me, though, is, I mean, Venezuela had such tremendous inequality. It wasn't a complete mystery that Chavez was able to win support. The rich were so rich, the poor were so poor in Venezuela. And now even those poor, Javier Corrales, have voted against that party. That is very striking.
Absolutely. Most polls we have looked at, as well as statistical analysis of polling data, reveal that your class doesn't predict how you're going to feel about the government. That now, at the beginning, the very poor, you could pretty much predict, were going to be on the side of Chavismo. But for many years now, actually, that was not a real predictor. And especially now, and what we have seen in this election especially is that neighborhoods that were either very urban poor or very rural remote, traditional bastions of Chavismo, voted overwhelmingly for the opposition. In other words, even in districts where Chavismo used to win by 10, 12, 15 points, this time voted for the opposition.
Things change, and we're looking at that in Venezuela right now. We'll look later in this hour at the situation in France. Marine Le Pen's National Front gaining some big victories in regional voting there. Javier Corrales, Laura Carlson in Mexico, please stand by. Ty in Omaha, Nebraska. Ty, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm okay. What do you see, Ty?
Well, what I see as a student of international relations, I have a master's degree in it, and what I see is I guess you'd call it a crackback against the left. I mean, look at France.
Yep.
Look at our own elections in 2012. Look at the xenophobic comments that are gaining traction in this country. Look at what's happening in Argentina and Venezuela, and basically what you're having is historical reference in the fact that socialism does not work. You can't get something for nothing. I don't want you taking something that I earned and giving it to somebody who hasn't done anything. I mean, look, you got American university students thinking they should go to college for free just because. It's not going to work, and people are getting mad at it.
Ty, we got it to you. It's just plain as a nose on one's face. Of course, if you lived in Venezuela over all these years, there was a time when people went the other way, but you're right, and it's right now. One more right here. Steve in Franklin, Connecticut. Steve, you're on.
Hi, Tom. We shouldn't be at all surprised when we see something like Venezuela turning finally back to something of more sanity. The system does not work, as your previous caller said. As Javier Corrales said, he explained it very well.
Mm-hmm.
There were problems before, and it was a democracy, but you had incompetent presidents, you had greed, you had the military. But even then, all the years that I traveled to Venezuela, there was always food on the shelves. There were always jobs if people wanted to work. So let's hope that the system goes back to a real democracy, and maybe the greed will stay in control and things will get moved towards a normal direction.
Democracy plus greed and control. That sounds like a good combination. Let me get one more, and I'll take it to our guest, Steve. Thank you. Nancy in Atlanta, Georgia. Nancy, you're on.
Hey, hello.
Hi, Nancy. What do you see?
Well, basically, everything sounds so great for the opposition. They're the winner, but that's not the truth over there. Because after too many years of corruption, do you think those people want to leave the opposition rule the country? It's not possible, because they have right now, and that was created by Chavez, they call Comuna, which one is a group. They are the one going to rule the country. So the opposition, yes, they win everything, but still behind the scene, the government are the one keep on going with the politicals in Venezuela.
Nancy, are you Venezuelan yourself?
Yes, sir.
So you may know what you're speaking of. Javier Corrales, what about the Comuna? Nancy's not confident that the power structure is going to give it up.
This is a remarkable point to highlight. One of the things that Chavez did is to transform Venezuela into what we now call hybrid regimes. These are regimes that have all the trappings of democracy, but outside of election day, concentrate a bunch of power within the executive branch and undermine all institutions of checks and balances. So the president creates a number of parallel organizations, and the comunas are one of them, that are staffed by loyalists, respond only to the president, and receive all privileges in terms of making decisions and running things. We're going to see a showdown now, because we have this institutional architecture built by Chavez and now Maduro, concentrating power on these institutions that orbit around the executive branch, and now the opposition took one of those institutions away from that orbit, the Congress, and is going to try to act from it. Who knows what's going to happen? There will be an institutional showdown of sorts, because it's almost like thinking there are two poles, institutional poles. What is remarkable about what the opposition has done is that it has won so many seats in Congress that the Constitution grants these majorities far more powers from Congress than you would expect. So the opposition could turn ballistic as a result of having this much power. And rather than moderation, we might end up seeing a real institutional confrontation, because there's no question that the executive branch in Venezuela still has mechanisms for running things and even try to circumvent the Congress.
Laura, we just have half a minute before the break, and we'll come back to this, but how do you see the path ahead? A kind of calm and negotiated move here, or Congress versus the rest of government, versus the Comuna and more?
I think that it's too soon to predict a violent confrontation, and I would not predict a violent confrontation at this point, because both sides have to be responsible, and I hope that that would assuage some of the fears that Nancy has. And in general, I think that there will be a showdown. But in the end, since this was such a pragmatic and non-ideological vote at the root regarding the economic situation, both the new legislature and the president have got to figure out how to work to solve the problems, which could mean that there will be less polarization. And also, by taking power, this could also mean that the more moderate sectors, because it's a very diverse bunch, this opposition coalition.
Laura, hold the thought if you'd be so kind. Laura Carlson in Mexico City, Javier Corrales at Amherst College. We're talking Venezuela's big vote history. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
On Point is sponsored by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses, made in America. They're engineered for comfort and long-lasting support, with just the right sink, just the right bounce. Two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, come together for better nights and brighter days. It's outrageous comfort at a polite price. Here's the great part. You can try one risk-free for 100 days, with free delivery and returns. Go to casper.com/onpoint. That's casper.com/onpoint. And remember to use promo code ONPOINT at checkout to receive a special offer. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Venezuela voting to turn back the Hugo Chavez revolution, a historic rejection of leftist populism at the polls over the weekend, and a wider questioning of the so-called pink tide in Latin America. Javier Corrales is with us from Amherst College, professor of political science there. Laura Carlson is with us from Mexico City and the Center for International Policy, the America's Policy Program there. You can join us. Why did the Chavez path finally lead to so much chaos and scarcity? And how does Venezuela make a change without going back to the hyper-inequality and ignoring the poor? We'll check in on right-wing victories in France, Marine Le Pen's National Front over the weekend in a moment. Lots of callers here. Hisela from Newton, Massachusetts. Hisela, you're on the air. Thank you for calling. What do you see?
Thank you so much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just called to make a comment. I think we need to be cautiously optimistic here. I think I have to confess that I was one that was not sure that this was going to happen. So I'm thrilled that it happened. But, you know, this is going to be a very, very slow process of change. And I think my hope is that some moderation, as your, you know, guest mentioned, is crucial here, because this is an issue that has taken, you know, far too away from the reality. The economy is the worst in the world. The inflation could not be worse, and I believe it's also the worst in the world. So it's going to be a very slow process to go back to, you know, a sensible economy and a way of living in Venezuela. The other part is, you know, how you mentioned that, how the new, you know, opposition, mm-hmm. is the position that we have now that will be joining the power, you know, it's doesn't forget the poor and doesn't forget what it used to be. I am hopeful that the new generation that is now leading this opposition has, you know, gone into the trenches, understands, you know, the poor, and will be able to balance it out. But I'm thrilled that this is happening, because this is, you know, a way into the future. Venezuela cannot continue, could not continue, you know, being a hungry country with all the oil reserves that we have.
Hisela, I appreciate your perspective there. You sound very level-headed. Cautious hope for moderation. A long trail ahead, though, and that is clear. I appreciate it. Great to have that call. One more here from Miami, if I may. Kevin Antonio, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for bringing up the subject. We in South Florida keep a close eye on what happens in Venezuela.
Yes.
And I'm a journalist myself, and there's something here that I don't think has been touched, because there's other issues having to do with the, let's say, the healing having to do in Venezuela, and there's a lot of there's high crimes and misdeeds in Elsinore, or should we say Miraflores, because nobody's mentioned the fact that it is pretty much almost a fait accompli that this government is in drug dealing. And Javier brought up the another issue, which was that the access to the dollars meant that a political class had access to enrich themselves at the expense of the treasury of the country.
Kevin Antonio, make the question. Our time is short, if you'd be kind enough, sir.
Okay. So does Javier think that this will be swept under the rug and they're going to start anew, or will there have to be some kind of reckoning with these issues?
Thank you. Javier, drug dealing, corruption, allegations there, and, you know, the high crimes, and what now?
In every form of transition away from bad governance, the new leaders have to decide how much to punish the wrongdoers in the past. And I tend to agree that there are a lot of members of the government who have committed a lot of wrong things, illegal things, things that one should be ashamed of. But it is very important to rescue the point about moderation. if the opposition takes a very punitive approach, they might rekindle the Chavistas. They might make the Chavistas unwilling to negotiate. And so this is going to be one of the trickiest issues. What do you do with the offenses of the past? Do you something has to be done, no doubt about it, but you want to make sure that you do not turn too vengeful. And this is one of the challenges for the opposition.
Kevin, Antonio, they're talking about the Palacio Miraflores, the presidential palace there in Venezuela. Wow. Laura, we heard Gisela talk about what a long trail is ahead. I mean, it's kind of overwhelming to fight your way back from this deep hole.
Yeah, it is. And I need to make a quick clarification, too, because I did say, and I think there's overall consensus, that Venezuela is a basket case economically. However, I did not say that this is proof that the model has failed and that neoliberalism is the future, not just for Venezuela, but for the entire continent, because I don't believe that. We look to Bolivia and other countries where we see that there have been significant gains, and particularly for the most vulnerable and least powerful sectors of society. So since they're the least powerful, you don't hear about that as often. And we can recall that the IMF recognized significant gains in a certain period of Venezuela's history. And then from here in Mexico, we look at the other side of it, and we see that the poster child for neoliberalism, Mexico, has had flatline growth during almost the entire period, is now facing an increase in poverty and severe inequality.
So what?
So we can't make generalizations like Ty and Steve mentioned, I think, about this model being overturned within the country.
Fair enough. Then for those concerned about the poor, and inequity was huge in Venezuela, what is the lesson, the positive lesson that can be drawn out of this?
Well, I think the positive lesson has to do with more the micromanaging of economic decisions and how you begin to integrate more redistribution of wealth, which is certainly necessary throughout what is the most unequal continent in the world, without creating these huge problems that Venezuela has. And that's a challenge that everyone deals with on a day-to-day basis that I don't think can be resolved by making blanket ideological statements.
Javier, where do you see that redistribution effort having failed in this case? I mean, there are a lot of things were redistributed, but ultimately, if you don't have an economy functioning, it's hard to keep it up.
Look, an oil state should have the easiest time redistributing because you don't need to tax the rich. So it shouldn't have been that poorly run. This is the easiest place where this could have worked. Why did it fail in Venezuela? Because in Venezuela, the state overreached. It generated these macroeconomic imbalances. It overspent beyond its means, and it punished the private sector. That was the mistake. Now, the tragedy is that when you have this form of populism to this extreme, then you make neoliberal policies almost inevitable. Now Venezuela is going to have to make very severe adjustments. You're going to have to bring the kind of policies that Laura doesn't like and nobody really likes, because they have a high potential of hurting the poor, cutting back the deficit and cutting spending and discontinuing a lot of programs. There are very few options at this point, and this is the result of an excessive degree of statism and populism. One possible solution is if the government eliminates inflation quickly and produces an investment boom through oil, which is possible, you might be able to protect the poor as you go through the adjustment. It is not unimaginable, but one has to be very careful and very attentive to that.
We wish the best for Venezuela. A very big vote this weekend, and absolutely fascinating to get this a terrific analysis of what's just gone on there from you, Javier Corrales of Amherst College, and from you, Laura Carlson, with the America's Policy Program, the Center for International Policy in Mexico City. I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Javier, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Laura Carlson, thank you as well.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, France's far-right National Front wins big in French elections. This is On Point.
Marine Le Pen and her National Front sent shockwaves across France on Sunday when they won regional elections in a landslide, and her hard right party looks set for more victories ahead. Here's the sound of Marine Le Pen speaking to a crowd of supporters after her party won 28% of the national vote in first round regional elections on Sunday.
The people have spoken, and thanks to them, France can lift up its head. This result confirms what the previous vote suggested, but what political pundits weren't willing to admit. The national movement is now uncontestably France's number one party, even if it's barely represented in parliament.
Marine Le Pen there in France after a strong showing over the weekend at the polls. Joining me now from Paris to explain, Stacey Maiktree, Deputy Paris Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. Stacey, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What happened here?
Well, I think what we're seeing is the result of deep frustration within the French public with a government that they feel isn't serving their interests. I mean, in particular, there's frustration with the European Union and some of its key cornerstones. And here we're talking about the euro, the common currency. And we're talking about the, system of almost like borderless travel across Europe. And that system is being blamed in part for the Paris terror attacks. There's a feeling that the government is no longer protecting the French people sufficiently. And as a result, they're turning to an alternative from the hard right that people once thought was, completely out of reach of power. This was once considered a fringe party, if you will.
A lot of Americans will not have followed French politics much. When you call Le Pen's National Front hard right, what do you mean? What are the most striking planks in that platform?
Well, they were born as a neo-fascist party, so they quite literally take their symbol, the tricolor flame, from the Italian fascists. Their sort of original founder, Jean-Marie Le Pen, is
her father.
He's known in France for having once described the Holocaust gas chambers as a mere, quote, detail of history. So this is somebody who has long trafficked in inflammatory rhetoric, and his daughter, to a certain extent, she's tried to refashion the image of the party as something more moderate and mainstream. But there's still a high degree of skepticism as to how far the National Front really has gone in remaking some of its fundamentals.
There's furor in the United States today over Donald Trump and his comments on Muslims and over time on immigration in general. What about the National Front in France on immigration?
Well, the National Front has always described immigration as a menace to France, and in particular to France's national identity. The rhetoric is that immigrants arriving in particular from North Africa and the Middle East are somehow remaking the country demographically. Now, France, as you know, is already hosts one of Europe's biggest Muslim minorities, and it's been a difficult process of integration. You've had various waves of North African immigrants over the years, in particular coming from Algeria, that have never really found a foothold in France. And what we now see are the younger generations, the children of those immigrants growing up and really struggling to fit into French society. So from that tension, you have parties like National Front seizing on the public's unhappiness, basically, with how these groups are struggling to fit in.
Explain how this voting over the weekend puts the National Front within reach of power. You had about a third of voters, quite large for this group, backing the National Front. They won in 6 out of France's 13 regions. But this was just a first round voting. A second round is coming on December 13th. What is all this heading toward? Where does it put them in relationship to real power?
Right. So this is a classic dynamic in French politics or in the election cycle. You have the first round of voting, which is basically designed to give smaller third party challengers a chance to to gain a piece of the vote. But what happens is that the political field is usually narrowed, and those third party candidates fall off. And then you have, you know, two mainstream party candidates going at each other in the second round. So what Marine Le Pen has managed to do here is turn it into a real three-way race. And surprisingly, she happens to be in pole position. So she has the number one spot. You have a center-right party run by Nicolas Sarkozy, the former French president. And then bringing up the rear in third place, you have the socialists, which is, of course, led by the current president of France, François Hollande. So the challenge here for the mainstream parties is to do what the French refer to as triangulation. Okay, and this would involve one of the mainstream parties basically telling their voters to back the other mainstream party in order to form some sort of blocking alliance against the National Front.
And if they don't succeed in that, what's the wildest dream of the National Front here?
Well, in the short term, the dream is to, you know, for the first time attain regional presidencies. And, you know, that's equivalent to becoming the you know, the governor of a state in the U.S. In the long term, you know, once the National Front has proven that they can govern on a local level, once they're given that megaphone, you know, to criticize the central government or the federal government, if you will, then they have a real shot at the 2017 presidential elections. Now, you know, if you talk to pollsters, political scientists here in France today, they'll tell you, you know, it's the longest of shots. There's no way that the French people are going to actually vote Marine Le Pen as France's next president in the heart of Europe, one of the most powerful countries in the EU. That said, the more and more she wins, there is a sort of snowball effect, and it does start to seem like she can possibly make a case. It's still a long shot, but she's now being taken seriously.
Politics in motion in a big way, under pressure in France. Stacey Miketrie with the Wall Street Journal in Paris. Thank you very much for joining us, Stacey.
Thank you, Tom.
On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica. With help from Fatima Tanis and Dave Tarantino, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thank you for joining us today. This is On Point.